This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/farmreport.
Right. Hello, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. During this summer 2020 season of the show, I've been focusing on how farms and food businesses are pivoting, adjusting, and adapting to this new world to feed their communities and people all over the country during the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest today is Jordan Seisler. Jordan, did I say your name right?
You did.
Okay, Jordan Seisler, the CEO of Handsome Brook Farms, a company that sells organic, pasture-raised eggs from a network of small farms around the country. Jordan, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa. Nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, you too. I'm so excited to finally have you on the show. I was going to ask you about your last name before and I forgot, but you know, it's I'm glad I got it right, first of all. So, you know, last week's episode was on local meat processing, and I did this whole introduction about how when we think about how the pandemic has affected the food system, disruptions in meat production are definitely at the top of the list in terms of the biggest impacts that we've seen, I think, and that people are talking about. But eggs have also been in the news a lot, mostly for one specific reason, which is that prices have gone up a ton at the grocery store. So let's just start there. So Handsome Brook Farm eggs are already more expensive at the grocery store compared to conventional. Have you had to raise prices during the pandemic?
No, we haven't. And, you know, I think that's obviously something that reflects our commitment to our customers as well as, you know, is a reflection also of our contract model with our growers, which is basically a fixed price that we offer our grower network and in turn allows us to sort of back to back to our customer base and hold prices consistent despite, you know, a pretty unprecedented surge in demand.
Yeah. So why have prices for conventional eggs gone up so much? Like what are conventional egg companies doing differently that you haven't had to face?
Sure. So I think, you know, the biggest difference between conventional eggs and specialty eggs is conventional eggs are priced based on an index known as the Erner-Berry index. And so there's actually a quoted, you know, metric that governs egg pricing. And when the pandemic hit, you know, the surge demand that came with stay-at-home orders and to some extent, I think, at the top of the pandemic, some panic buying on top of just the realization that people would be eating home, really sort of created a very short-term supply-demand imbalance that took average commodity prices from the low $1, you know, sub $1.20. I don't know the exact, you know, quote, but to as high as, I think, $3.38. So, you know, over 300%. And so I think that was sort of the market function of this index reacting. At the same time, I think the index and the price of commodity eggs fell about as fast as it rose, as certain measures were taken to open up, I guess, the chains where certain supply had been directed into food service that was no longer necessary. And once those eggs found their way into shelf ready cartons, some of that was introduced into the retail food supply. And then I think, you know, buying patterns, I guess, subsided. I think, you know, certainly eggs remain in strong demand today, but even as we sit here in early June versus mid-March, I think consumer eating habits change seasonally, and that's always been part of sort of the egg market, you know, annual cycle. So, you know, you've got a number of factors with, you know, both states opening up, people stop, you know, eating as much hot breakfast in the warmer months, and I guess how much banana bread can one eat? you know, the baking and the meals at home and all the rest of it that led to that spike. You know, I think it was a sort of a confluence of factors, and then a normalization of flow, or an additional of flow back into retail that helped satisfy demand, and correspondingly, you saw commodity prices fall back into again the low $1 range here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so interesting just how supply chains have been impacted, and you know, seeing prices rise and fall. And I just right before we started recording, I actually saw that this morning in Politico's Morning Ag newsletter, they reported too that there's this whole other segment of the egg industry, which are farmers that produce eggs for the liquid egg market.
Yes.
And oh my gosh, the governor of Iowa sent a letter to Secretary Perdue saying that, you know, most of Iowa's egg producers, something like 70%, actually produce eggs for the liquid egg market, which is all restaurants, hospitals, you know, food service, all the places that shut down. And those producers, the prices have plummeted and they can't sell their product. And, you know, they're asking for help from the government, from the CFAP program. But it just made me think about, you know, it's like there's so many different channels and the market is so big and complicated. And but I guess, you know, in your case, it's not that complicated. I think your supply chain is a lot simpler, right?
it is and it is. Yes. I mean, we have a kind of a somewhat proprietary supply chain in terms of how we're structured. But yeah, we definitely, you know, fortunately for Hanson Brook, our end markets have been principally retail focused. And so we didn't have the same food service exposure that those farmers in Iowa are unfortunately suffering from. And, you know, just real quick, I think you had mentioned, you know, the meat processors and some of the disruption and so forth. I mean, I think the largest liquid egg processor in the country, Michael's Foods, has been severely impacted, and if either has filed for bankruptcy protection or is preparing to do so, I'm not certain whether that's occurred or not. But it's just in support of what you're saying. I think unfortunately, there are pockets of the market that are, you know, doing very poorly, while others are doing quite well, and you know, we're very fortunate to be positioned in the latter.
Yeah. Well, and you were mostly doing retail already. So, did you see a large spike in demand over the last few months?
We certainly did. You know, we had certain weeks that were just unprecedented in terms of order growth being, you know, several 100% above normal, and then, you know, certainly a tapering off and a leveling, because that certainly wouldn't have been sustainable from a supply perspective at all. And but I think if we look at Hanson Brook through end of May, we're probably up nearly 30% year on year, with the biggest difference being, you know, very little promotional activity in 2020. So most of those eggs that we've sold have been sold, you know, truly at full retail versus, you know, the type of trade support that we often provide to our trading partners, you know, to promo eggs.
And has it been challenging to keep up with the demand while also just dealing with, you know, the variables that COVID-19 has introduced, such as, you know, increased protections you need to put in place for employees, kind of changing processes to keep people safe, and like what does that look like?
Sure. It has been challenging, but I think we've done a tremendous job adapting, and certainly the health and safety of our employees at every level of the organization, as well as the, you know, more than 80 families that comprise our grower network, were paramount when considering, you know, what measures that we were going to take to maintain supply chain integrity, but also protect the individuals that really are at the heart of what we do. We sort of on a staff level implemented stay at home measures across the company. We're headquartered in New York, as you know, Lisa. So, you know, that was an easy decision to send people home.
Right.
You know, but we also are an essential business. So, you know, the question became, do we send our field staff out to the farms, uninterrupted? And we sort of spoke with our team and determined it best to adhere to stay at home, notwithstanding, you know, necessary visits like SE swabs, necessary bloods, you know, drawing blood to go get lab results, depopulations, repopulations, and so forth. But, you know, we work with, a variety of growers across 10 states, largely in rural Amish and Mennonite communities, and certainly didn't want to be sort of the reason why any one community got exposed to coronavirus or, you know, something exogenous based on our account. So we've since, as of June 1st, re-implemented field visits, but with other measures, you know, to basically avoid human contact. I mean, we want our staff going out and checking up on the flocks and the state of the farms, but doing so in a socially, you know, socially distant, compliant manner as it relates to direct grower engagement. And certainly, you know, additional hand sanitizer. And, you know, we already were in bio suits and protective booties and, you know, foot baths with bleach and all the things that we kind of incorporate into our core biosecurity protocols, especially as an organic producer, you know, are really important. The good news is we were doing a lot of this stuff the right way to begin with. It's just more about an additional measure of caution and distancing. Truckers were advised as well to avoid personal contact with the growers. Egg pickups were being done, purposefully without saying hello or, you know, collaborating on loading pallets and so forth. So, that was at the farm level. I think at the packing level, you've got another set of protocols that were implemented through our co-packers.
Yeah, it seems like there might be more people working in one place.
Yeah, then there you're more shoulder to shoulder. I mean, not literally, but, you know, certainly nothing like what, you know, Smithfield and Sioux Falls sounded like. But the other nice thing about our network and the way we've structured ourselves being multi-regional is that we work with four co-packers to, you know, basically create a more localized or regionalized production system. And, you know, therefore we don't tax any one facility, you know, too greatly. And, you know, we kind of built our farm production network and our packing network to mitigate concentration risk, you know. So I think, fortunately, we were pretty well positioned. And should anything have happened in any one place, we had three others to go to, you know, if we had, you know, God forbid. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And, I think the integrity of our supply chain held up really well. And that wasn't without a lot of help and care taken at every level. And we certainly appreciate the job that, you know, our staff, our third-party truckers and co-packers, have done during this, you know, sort of crazy time in our companies and frankly our national history.
Right, absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about just the Hansenberg Farms model and, you know, how you were able to be set up well for this moment in time and what you do differently. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its order hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/farmreport.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I have been talking to Jordan Seisler, the CEO of Hansenberg Farms, a organic and pasture-raised egg company. So we talked a lot about this moment in time and how you've been kind of weathering the storm of COVID-19. But I want to kind of take a step back and talk a little bit about Hansenberg Farms overall and you know, the company, what makes it different. And you mentioned, Jordan, that you have about 80 families in your grower network.
That's correct.
Can you talk about, can you talk about where they are, first of all?
Sure. So we started in upstate New York with five hens on a single farm, we now have over 80 partner farms across 10 states. That includes New York, PA, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. I think I've got them all. It sounds, you know, disparate, but you know, I think the key to our business has been sort of organizing discrete regions and clustering these small farm partners together in you know, as logistically efficient a configuration as we can, and we work at that every day. But we have a fairly decent sized footprint at this point, and we're proud to be the largest producer of organic pasture raised eggs in the United States.
Interesting. And so you're the largest producer of organic pasture-raised eggs, but it's, you know, each farm is not that large in the, you know, on the landscape. It's, you're sort of going for aggregation rather than consolidation, I think. Would you say that that's a...
That's 100% accurate. And that we've scaled the business through aggregation as opposed to concentration in any one place or in any one facility. And I think that's what's allowed us to, you know, continue to grow incrementally and at the same time, you know, not introduce risk into the mix the way, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes scaling in a particular concentrated manner invites.
Yeah. And how big is a typical farm?
An average flock is somewhere between 9,500 and 10,000 hens.
Okay.
So that's pretty small, you know, you know, relative to, you know, a typical cage-free complex facility. It can have 150,000 birds in a house. It can have 40,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ranges, but it's really quite antithetical to, you know, call it factory farming or industrial complex farming. Yeah.
Yeah. And the farms are smaller. They're just fewer hens. But the production system also looks differently. Can you talk a little bit about how the practices on the farm differ from conventional or even really from organic systems, right?
Sure. So, I mean, we do have an organic system, but it's an organic pastured system. And so when you introduce pasture raised as a welfare standard, you're talking about 400 hens per acre of outdoor access. So that 10,000, call it average 10,000 hen farm requires 25 organic acres of pasture for the birds to be able to roam and graze and forage and do their chicken thing. So, you know, it's quite land intensive. What without being as fixed asset facility or barn intensive. And so, you know, when you kind of overlay the welfare and the organic, it becomes a pretty unique operation, particularly at our scale, just because it's not that easy to find that many places that haven't, you know, sprayed their land either knowingly or unknowingly with something that would preclude one from obtaining organic certification. And that's the sad reality of the farming system in this country today, as I believe you know.
So how are you finding farmers to join the network? Like, do they come to you? Do you actually go out and look for people? How does that work?
Sure. So I think we've built our network through, you know, really success begets success, and word of mouth, I think, becomes the most effective tool. And when you kind of understand the dynamics of the Amish and Mennonite communities, you're talking about, you know, fairly insular communities, but also highly interconnected communities across state lines, and certainly even within a state across county lines. So, you know, I think really you kind of have to prove yourself as a business and make, you know, and demonstrate that your contract cash flows. And once it does, and once you've proven that, you know, you're a good company to work with and you support the growers' needs and help them, you know, many of our growers were first time, you know, layer hen farmers. So, you know, we had to sort of put the infrastructure in place to be able to help them learn how to do this the right way without, you know, sort of making too many critical mistakes early on. And, you know, but once you do it the first time, it gets certainly a whole lot easier. And like I said, success begets success. And I think we had a really strong network effect through the success of, you know, many growers.
Yeah. They kind of talk to each other about the company and then refer people to you. And I think it's interesting that you said a lot are new to laying hens. Is it a lot of farmers who were maybe doing something else and then add the Handsome Brook to their farm? Because I feel like you could have a bigger farm and kind of be doing vegetables or, you know, doing something else and then add like a barn for laying hens as well.
Yes. So I think we've had a good mix of growers, some of whom were either doing some dairy, doing some other livestock, some of them doing vegetables and crops or flowers. Many of them, though, were principally earning their living off farm. And I think when Handsome Brook was introduced as a potential opportunity, I think the excitement was for many of our growers to have the opportunity to be full-time on farm and, you know, kind of embrace a lifestyle that many of their cultures was heavily rooted in, but you know, certainly economically wasn't entirely always viable. And you know, yeah, we were talking earlier about sort of the size of the farms, and you know, it's economically intensive or financially intensive or, you know, capital intensive to build a large barn. So having a you know, call it a 10,000 head barn on average, like I said, you know, relatively easily underwritten, you know, capital project for the farmer using Hanson Brooks' contract, along with, you know, either funds that they have available or through, you know, the lending community, be it, you know, commercial lenders with or without FSA support. So, you know, I think it's, we're really proud that we offer this sort of opportunity for folks to really live the life that they've been wanting to live. You know, many of them were other, you know, were tradespeople, you know, carpenters, fabricators, manufacturers of some sort, who dabbled in farming, but, you know, weren't able to really support the family full time at home.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned earlier a little bit about, you know, working with your farmers through the pandemic. Have you heard anything about how the farmers have been impacted? I mean, if your demand has been pretty much up or steady, I would imagine economically they haven't been impacted that much. Have they been affected in other ways? Like, what are you hearing from the farmers themselves?
It's interesting. I think, you know, because we're so geographically diverse, you've got, you know, different situations in a lot of different places. Mm. But, you know, I think one way their relationship with us has been impacted is, you know, part of our ability to fulfill the demand was to, wherever possible, extend the productive life of the hen. So if there was a depopulation scheduled for, you know, 80 weeks, if we were able to get an extra, you know, 4 to 5 weeks of production by moving the pullet placements around, we were trying to take advantage of opportunities to do so. And, you know, largely that is not a unilateral decision of Hanson Brooks. It has to be made, you know, in partnership with the farmer, because certainly they have to agree to do it, and they need enough time to clean up and get ready for the next flock in between. But, you know, economically, that generally is a win-win for both Hanson Brooks and the grower to be able to take the birds out a bit longer. So that's, you know, one way that this sort of situation has impacted the growers. But, you know, certainly I think it was remarkable to me, particularly, you know, in sort of mid-March, just really understanding that, you know, many of our farmers effectively have been quarantining forever, right? I mean, the way they live, the type of, you know, distance between their farms and their neighbors' farms. Aside from really convening, you know, on Sundays, you know, at church for religious ceremonies, you know, they live quite a secluded, you know, independent lifestyle. So, you know, in certain respects, not much changed at all. But I think in other respects, you know, farmers still have to go to the store and, you know, buy their goods. And, you know, many of them are going to Walmarts or, you know, large format stores where, you know, they can buy in bulk. And you know, anytime you're leaving an insular community to, you know, enter a more potentially exposed situation, I think everybody, you know, had apprehensions. But, you know, fortunately, we none of our farmers fell ill to COVID or coronavirus. And I think things, you know, fared overall quite well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great to hear. So one thing I want to ask you before we wrap up is, you know, through this whole pandemic, there's been a lot of focus on different aspects of the food system and a lot of conversations about how people are exposed to where their food comes from and how it gets to them more than they ever have been before, kind of being forced to think about food production, maybe in ways that they hadn't before. And in some cases, that may or may not be leading to changes in behavior around buying food. I'm curious when it comes to eggs and, you know, specifically Hansenbrook Farms, the business you do, do you think that COVID-19 is going to have any long-term effects on your business or, you know, the sort of organic pasture-raised egg market?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, in that this is, unfortunately or fortunately, COVID has been, good for business. And I know that sounds odd, but it's a silver lining story for our grower network and our company. But it's also really great that we were here and prepared and able to support, not only our grower families across America, but, many families across America needing, healthy, quality organic proteins. And I think what we've seen thus far and some of the, studies that I've read, this has really, caused a lot of consumers to take a closer look at where their food comes from, sourcing practices, production practices, supply chain practices. And, I think, it also provided an opportunity for certain consumers who were not necessarily familiar with Hansenbrook to try our brand, whether it was by choice or by lack of choice of what was on the shelf. Mm-hmm. But, we've been contacted by several consumers who, told us that, now that they've experienced what our eggs taste like, it they're never going back, and I think it's mm-hmm. it's great to see that. And certainly, I think that as consumer spending habits change, both in terms of the overall economic climate, but also in terms of having less avenues to go spend your, discretionary income outside the home, sort of the idea behind quality food and particularly quality staples like eggs, I think makes a lot of sense to people. And, I'm hoping that we can continue to sustain these levels of sales, but certainly with, the bigger overall societal picture improving, of course,
Right.
But yeah, I definitely think it's put a real emphasis on, how did this food get here and who was involved in getting it to the store and to my fridge. And, I think we stack up really well when people start asking that question.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
This was great. Anytime, and, anything you want to chat about, I'd love to, to pick it up with you again down the road.
Great. Thanks. Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. I'll see you next week. The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.